Good morning. This is your reader, John Michael, for the Wall Street Journal. Israel to hold big parts of Gaza and run aid. Israel's security cabinet approved a new ground operation to occupy territory in the Gaza Strip in a strategic shift that would entail moving most of Gaza's population to an area cleared of militants and taking control of aid distribution. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel would retain a presence in areas it seizes in Gaza and would rely on the tens of thousands of reservists the military would call up as part of the offensive. One thing will be clear. They're not going in and out, Netanyahu said in a video posted to his X account on Monday, suggesting Israeli troops wouldn't quickly withdraw from areas as they did in the first ground operation after the October 7, 2023 Hamas-led attacks. The Prime Minister's documents appeared to clarify an earlier statement from an Israeli official that said the war plan approved on Monday includes conquering the Strip and holding the territory. The official didn't clarify whether the occupation would include all of the enclave or just key areas, or how long Israeli troops would remain. The new military operation comes after the appointment of a new military chief of staff, Ayel Zamir, who took over in early March after his predecessor resigned. Israel has steadily ratcheted up pressure on Hamas since a temporary ceasefire collapsed that month. Israel began with a blockade on all aid and commercial goods, then later resumed aerial bombardment and limited ground operations. The new offensive will begin gradually over the next 2 weeks to pressure the U.S.-designated terrorist group to accede to Israeli terms in a ceasefire for a hostage release deal before President Trump's expected visit to the Middle East in mid-May. Trump has repeatedly warned Hamas that it would face a resumption of violence if the group didn't release all remaining hostages. The new offensive breaks with the strategy Israel's military pursued in its initial ground operation when it raided Hamas strongholds and then retreated, allowing Hamas to re-infiltrate areas once the troops departed and rebuild. Zamir, Israel's new military chief and a former tank commander, has advocated a more aggressive approach. He understands that to really eradicate Hamas, you need to take over the whole Gaza Strip, says Amir Avivi, founder of the Israeli Defense and Security Forum think tank, which has close relations with Israel's government. The Israeli military's chief spokesperson, Effie Defrin, said the plan would require moving most of Gaza's population to an area said and would be cleared of militants. Aid groups have routinely cautioned against further displacing Gaza's civilians. Aid groups have recently warned that supplies of essentials such as food, fuel, clean water, and medicine are running dangerously low, deepening the humanitarian crisis and leading to an uptick in incidents of looting. Mohammed Alian, 57 years old, a resident of Beit Lahia in northern Gaza, said his family hasn't received any aid since the blockade began and is running out of food. He said he and 10 relatives crammed into a two-room house are now down to one meal a day, surviving off split red lentils and macaroni. Israel's cabinet also approved on Monday a plan to resume aid to Gaza by setting up about 6 to 10 aid distribution sites that would be protected by private U.S. security contractors. Israel accuses Hamas of stealing and diverting aid to fund its war effort. Aid groups said the claim is blown out of proportion and that humanitarian need outweigh the risks. Israel has long pressed humanitarian aid organizations to do more to monitor their stocks. Aid organizations said they have verification systems in place to prevent misdirection of their goods. Humanitarian groups working in Gaza, including United Nations agencies, said on Sunday they would take part in Israel's proposal because it would put civilians and aid workers at risk while also violating human principles. The cabinet hasn't said when the aid distribution plan would go into effect. Under Israel's proposal, aid would be distributed through a number of designated hubs, according to a spokesperson for the UN's humanitarian office in Gaza, Olga Cherovkov. Civilians would need to collect goods from these hubs, which she said would mean that assistance isn't equally accessible and could put them at risk by forcing them to travel through areas of continuing conflict. Aid groups also said the plan would violate their policy of neutrality by giving a party to the conflict, in this case Israel, too much control over who gets aid and how. Further control over aid operations by a party to the conflict would risk aid not reaching the most vulnerable at a time when it is needed the most, Cherovkov said. Trump threatens colleges if student loans not repaid. The Trump administration's latest threat to colleges and universities: get your former students to pay back their loans, or future students might not get any. The administration is invoking rules that allow the government to shut off the federal student loan spigot for specific schools if too many of their former students have lapsed on payments, according to a notice published by the Education Department on Monday. The government has long had the power to restrict federal student aid if too many students don't pay it back. A check intended to make sure the government isn't on the hook for degrees that don't pay off for the graduates. Losing eligibility for federal aid is a potentially devastating blow to a school's ability to attract students. A far bigger group of schools is now at risk because so many students never resumed paying back their loans after a pandemic pause. Nearly 10 million borrowers are either already in default or on the cusp, the Education Department said. Within a few months, about a quarter of borrowers nationwide could be in default, meaning they are at least 9 months behind on payments. For many borrowers, the urgency of repayment is a shock after the policies of the Biden administration, which tried to cancel swaths of student debt. The warning, reported on Monday by the Wall Street Journal, is a plank in a broader strategy to accelerate repayments. Also on Monday, the Education Department began putting defaulted student loans in collections. Almost 200,000 defaulted student loan borrowers have begun getting notices that tax refunds and federal benefits could be withheld to pay back their debt as soon as a month from now. As we begin to help defaulted borrowers pay back to repayment, we must also fix a broken higher education finance system that has put upward pressure on tuition rates without ensuring that colleges and universities are delivering a high-value degree to students, Education Secretary Linda McMahon said. Long-term, Republican lawmakers have been thinking about new ways to tighten the $1.6 trillion student loan program. I do think that there's some recognition, especially among Republicans, that maybe student loans are not an allied good, but that we do need to have some rethinking of whether the extensive borrowing is the right answer in every circumstance, said Preston Cooper, a senior fellow at the conservative-leaning American Enterprise Institute. The student loan warning is the Trump administration's latest in a series of broadsides against universities, a campaign that has focused on everything from allegations of anti-Semitism on campus to scrutinizing compensation for college athletes. In many cases, the Trump administration has moved to withhold research grants. Harvard University has sued the White House, alleging it has violated due process as well as the university's right to free speech. The Trump administration's approach on student aid relies on well-established precedent to keep schools accountable for the value of the education they provide. The Education Department said schools can be dropped from federal student aid if more than 30% of recent students have defaulted over the past 3 years, or if 40% have defaulted in the most recent year. Before the pandemic, very few colleges had such high default rates. Most that did were technical or trade schools. With student default rates nationally running at historic highs, it is likely that far more schools could see aid cut if default rates don't improve quickly. The Education Department is telling schools they should reach out to former students from the past 5 years and instruct them to make sure they haven't fallen behind. Cooper thinks it is unlikely that schools would help students make the payments, but they could curb future tuition costs. Getting loans back on track after the pandemic has become a quagmire for the government and for borrowers alike. Former President Joe Biden, a Democrat, tried to make some pandemic loan relief payment, but courts rebuffed some of his efforts. His administration extended a no-consequences period through the 2024 election. The Trump administration's move to put defaulted loans into collections could lead to garnished wages and withholding of federal income tax refunds and benefits like Social Security checks. The Education Department said that collecting on student loans is required by law and fiscally prudent. Many people with student loans, for their part, said that the end of the recent payment pause was handled poorly by the government and by the private companies that administer the loans on its behalf. Many borrowers said they never got proper notice that forbearance was ending and only found out that they were behind after noticing a big drop in their credit scores this year. Supporters of the Trump administration's stricter approach to student loan repayment argue that people with unpaid student loans shouldn't be singled out for extra help from the government. Tariff plot twist panics Hollywood. Hollywood has been pleading with politicians for years to help them stem the exodus of film and TV production to other countries. This weekend, actor Jon Voight met with President Trump to make the case. The president's call for 100% tariffs on imported movies, which he issued in social media post on Sunday, isn't what Hollywood had in mind. Entertainment industry executives expressed confusion over how a levy could be applied to intellectual property with no specific monetary value. They said they feared retaliatory tariffs could damage their business overseas, where big-budget movies often earn most of their box office receipts. Shares in Disney, Netflix, and other media companies and movie theater chains fell on Monday. More moves out of Washington could be coming. Voight said in an interview Monday that the tariff announcement was the beginning, perhaps, of changes that will be effective, and indicated that there might be more to Trump's plan. "There's a little bit for us to wait on," he said. Trump met last weekend at his Florida club Mar-a-Lago with Voight, his manager, Stephen Paul, and Paul's business partner, Scott Carroll. The president later read up further on the issue, people familiar with the matter said. "Many in Hollywood would like to see the federal government offer tax incentives that make the U.S. more competitive with rival countries." The International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees Union, which represents most behind-the-scenes craftspeople in Hollywood, asked the Trump administration Monday to implement a federal movie production tax incentive program. Camera operators, makeup artists, and other crew members have seen job opportunities in the U.S. shrink for years, because other countries offer generous tax incentives and have lower labor costs, motivating studios to produce films and TV shows there. IATSE said its members have lost thousands and tens of thousands of jobs in the U.S. in the past 2 years. Most big-budget Hollywood movies are now shot overseas to take advantage of tax breaks, according to people who have worked at studios. This year's highest-grossing film, a Minecraft movie, was shot in Canada. The next Mission Impossible sequel, which comes out on Memorial Day weekend, was shot entirely in the UK and other foreign locations. Voight, 86-year-old, star of such movies as Midnight Cowboy and National Treasure, has been one of Trump's main advisors on returning productions to the U.S. Trump named him a special ambassador to Hollywood in January. Voight discussed with Trump crafting a federal policy that would give film production companies tax incentives to conduct more of their business in the U.S., according to people familiar with the matter. Voight, Paul, and Carroll met with the Motion Picture Association of America, the trade group that represents studios and streaming companies, as well as Hollywood unions, before going to Mar-a-Lago last weekend, Carroll said. The trio proposed to Trump that he bring productions back to Hollywood through policies including federal tax incentives and infrastructure subsidies. They said tariffs should only be used in certain limited circumstances, according to a statement they released on Monday. Trump, while flying on Air Force One, later read through news articles about how certain production companies conduct some of their business in foreign countries, according to a person familiar with the matter. Trump, a Republican, later posted on Truth Social his plans for tariffs on foreign films that are seen in the U.S. "We're going to meet with the industry. I want to make sure they're happy with it because I'm all about jobs," Trump said on Monday. He didn't say when the tariffs would be implemented or how, and a White House spokesperson said no final decision on foreign film tariffs had been made. For most of the 20th century, American movies were shot primarily in Los Angeles, but over the past few decades, generous tax breaks have motivated film and TV companies to shoot wherever costs are lowest. Countries like the UK and Canada essentially subsidize every dollar spent there to hire cast and crews, rent stages, and do visual effects work. Many movies are being shot in regions like Eastern Europe with lower personal costs. The total amount of money spent last year on film and TV productions in the U.S. with budgets of more than $40 million fell 26% from 2 years earlier, according to research firm ProdPro. It rose during that period in the U.K. and Canada, though neither market has caught up to the U.S. Several U.S. states dangle their own production tax breaks. As a result, the number of days that films, TV shows, and commercials shot in Los Angeles during the first quarter of this year dropped 22.4% from the same period last year. How Trump's Alcatraz idea went over on The Rock. "To some in this city, turning Alcatraz back into a prison would be a crime. The Rock, which closed 62 years ago, is now a coveted tourist attraction, but President Trump wants to return the site back to its original function. San Francisco has channeled the public's macabre fascination with life inside the notorious prison to turn it into one of the city's top tourist attractions. Visitors can take a night tour where one can enjoy the beauty of a sunset silhouetting the Golden Gate Bridge, as well as experience a cell door demonstration. Enthusiasts can wander through the gardens of Alcatraz, peruse the big lockup exhibit, or take one of a myriad of tours, including one called Doing Time. Over the years, Boy Scouts have clamored to hold overnight campouts in the infamous isolation cells of D Block. Athletes compete in prison-themed events, including a canoe race circling the island and the Escape from Alcatraz triathlon. Calling the prison a symbol of law and order, Trump on Sunday said he is directing the Bureau of Prisons and other federal agencies to rebuild Alcatraz to house America's most ruthless and violent offenders. On Monday, National Park Ranger Matthew Connolly welcomed a crowd of more than 100 visitors and said he'd take questions. Just not all. When the subject of Trump's proposal came up, he looked concerned and directed reporters to call public affairs. Those on the PAC tour had plenty of thoughts after trudging from a ferry boat up a steep quarter-mile walkway to the imposing fortress. Before entering the main gate, an Australia visitor jokingly suggested Trump lock himself into a new prison there. He should lead by example, the man said with a laugh. He and his wife declined to give their names. No thanks, mate. We want to get home. Taking selfies with his wife in one of the windowless cells on a prison corridor called Broadway, John LaPierre, a 62-year-old tourist from the Netherlands, was supportive of Trump's plan. I think the idea itself, to put people on a certain island where they have no comfort, especially for those high delinquents, that's a good idea, LaPierre said. But he was wary of whether such an historic site could again be made into a modern prison complex. Sitting in what had been the Chow Hall, Londoners Chris Manikowski and Naomi Alexandra said that instead of doubling down on a prison with such stark conditions, Trump should take a page from Norway, which treats prisoners well and has low recidivism rates. I think times have changed, and for prisoners to spend a week without showering in those dark cells, it's too much, Manikowski, 28, said. Trump's pitch harks back to the prison's 1930s origins, when it opened to deal with the most incorrigible inmates in federal prisons. According to government history, it operated as a maximum security facility for nearly three decades, closing in 1963 because of millions of dollars in needed repairs and the expense of hauling all supplies, including fresh water, to the facility by boat. Alcatraz was tiny by the standards of most federal facilities, never housing more than around 275 prisoners. Its shadow is huge. The prison has graced the silver screen in such films as Michael Bay's 1996 action thriller, The Rock, and 1979's Escape from Alcatraz, starring Clint Eastwood. It housed famous criminals, including mobster Al Capone and George Machine Gun Kelly. At times, Alcatraz was almost as famous for those who tried to escape as it was for those who were inside. Contrary to myth, cold temperatures and strong currents, not sharks, were the biggest obstacles to making it the mile plus to shore. Trained swimmers as young as nine has successfully made the journey that so many prisoners failed. Today, more than a million visitors each year travel to the island, according to National Park Service. In peak season, tourists book tickets week in advance. Not everyone in San Francisco has understood why a sinister prison is such a draw. It's heinous, declared one writer on Broke-Ass Stewart, a local alternative website, noting the irony of a progressive city touting a museum of human suffering. I don't think moms from Minnesota would be allowed to take selfies in rooms where men pushed past the point of no return hung themselves. for those looking to bring a dose of reality back home from the prison tour, visitors can buy rectangular magnets reminding them of Alcatraz's central tenets. Like regulation number 5, you're entitled to food, clothing, shelter, and medical attention. Anything else you get is a privilege. Parents seeking some tough love discipline can slap regulation 23 on the fridge. If you make groundless complaints for the purpose of stirring up trouble, you will be subject to disciplinary action. For $13.95, tourists can also take home a replica tin inmate cup, which had the advantage back in the day of not being able to be broken into shards that could become a weapon. Carson Brock, a 24-year-old from Cincinnati who voted for Trump, said from the prison's gift shop that he favors preserving Alcatraz's history over reopening. "But if that's what he wants to do, then I guess so be it," he said. One Alberta resident touring the island was reticent to share her views, but concluded, "We Canadians, we really don't care." Visitor Mike Nelville, another Trump supporter, said he thinks turning Alcatraz back into a prison would be cost prohibitive. The 61-year-old visiting from Colorado Springs has a better plan. "I always liked the idea of turning it into a casino." China's official statistics are disappearing. Not long ago, anyone could comb through a wide range of official data from China. Then it started to disappear. Land sales measures, foreign investment data, and unemployment indicators have gone dark in recent years. Data on cremations and a business confidence index have been cut off. Even official soy sauce production reports are gone. In all, Chinese officials have stopped publishing hundreds of data points once used by researchers and investors, according to a Wall Street Journal analysis. In most cases, Chinese authorities haven't given any reason for ending or withholding data. But the missing numbers have come as the world's second busiest economy has stumbled under the weight of excessive debt, a crumbling real estate market, and other troubles, spurring heavy-handed efforts by authorities to control the narrative. The disappearing data have made it harder for people to know what's going on in China at a pivotal time. With the trade war between Washington and Beijing expected to hit China hard and weaken global growth, plunging trade with the U.S. has already led to production shutdowns and job cuts. Getting a true read on China's growth has always been tricky. Many economists have long questioned the reliability of China's headline gross domestic product data, and concerns have intensified recently. Official figures put GDP growth at 5% last year and 5.2% in 2023. But some have estimated that Beijing overstated its numbers by as much as 2 to 3 percentage points. to get what they consider to be more realistic assessments of China's growth, economists have turned to alternative sources such as movie box office revenues, satellite data on the intensity of nighttime lights, the operating rates of cement factories, and electricity generation by major power companies. Some parse location data from mapping services run by private companies, such as Chinese tech giant Baidu, to gauge business activities. One economist said he has been assessing the health of China's services sector by counting news stories about owners of gyms and beauty salons who abruptly close up and skip town with users' membership fees. Questions over China's GDP figures go back years. Former Chinese Premier Li Keqiang famously told the U.S. ambassador in 2007 that GDP data for a Chinese province he governed at the time were man-made and therefore unreliable, according to a leaked U.S. diplomatic cable. Instead, he said he kept track of electricity consumption, rail freight volumes, and new bank loans. Official GDP figures were for reference only, he confided to the ambassador, according to the cable. Li died in October 2023. China's official GDP growth of 5% in 2024 exactly matched the target the government had set the previous year. Economists privately dismissed the figure, with one telling the journal it would have been more credible if authorities had released something lower. Retail sales, construction activity, and other data painted a considerably weaker picture, they noted. In December, a prominent Chinese economist at state-owned SDIC Securities, Gao Shanwen, said at a conference in Washington that China's economic growth might be around 2% the past few years, adding, "We do not know the true number of China's real growth figure." Chinese leader Xi Jinping ordered that Gao be disciplined, and he has been banned from speaking publicly for an unspecified period. The Securities Association of China warned brokerages in late December to ensure their economists play a positive role in boosting investor confidence. China's Statistics Bureau has defended its data practices, saying that data quality has improved over the years and that it has taken steps to ensure accuracy and investigate any misconduct during collection. In February, Goldman Sachs came up with an alternative way of measuring China's economic growth by crunching figures such as import data, which can be read as proxies for domestic spending. The thinking was that trade data get published frequently and is hard to fudge, since China's trading partners also report those numbers. That approach implied that China's growth in 2024 averaged 3.7%. Using a different method, the Rhodium Group, a New York-based research outfit, said growth was closer to 2.4% in 2024. Often, the data that go missing involve areas of high sensitivity or headaches for Beijing, such as the property market, whose collapse in recent years wiped out billions of dollars of household wealth and triggered protests by frustrated homebuyers. During the boom years, China's developers furiously bought up land from local governments at sky-high prices. The transaction poured money into local government coffers and signaled future development plans, a key driver of the economy. The downturn began in 2021 after Beijing tightened credit on the sector. With home sales falling and real estate developers going bankrupt, a Chinese think tank called Beike Research Institute released a report in 2022 that found the average housing vacancy rate among 28 Chinese cities was higher than the average in the U.S. and other places, a sign of oversupply. The report drew attention because China doesn't release an official vacancy rate, and property analysts were trying to figure out how badly developers had overbuilt. A few days later, Beike retracted the report and apologized, saying that some of the data had errors. Analysts said they believed the group pulled the data under government pressure. Official data went away, too. Figures show the value of land sales plummeted 48% in 2022, a big problem for heavily indebted local governments, which suddenly lacked funds to pay salaries or carry on with infrastructure projects. That data disappeared at the start of 2023. In this case, there are still private data providers that gather individual land transactions at the local level from public records. By mid-2023, much of the talk locally revolved around the dismal job market for young people. Many of the students finishing colleges didn't have job offers, and viral social media posts showed them dressed in caps and gowns, splayed out motionless on the ground, interpreted by many as a form of silent protest. Around that time, the official youth unemployment rate hit a record of 21.3%. Zhang Dandan, a Peking University economist, made headlines by saying she thought China's true youth unemployment rate might be as high as 46.5%. In August 2023, authorities announced they would stop releasing the youth unemployment rate, saying they needed to revisit how they calculated those figures. 5 months later, Beijing began releasing a new data series. The real youth jobless rate, it said, was 14.9%. Officials said that the new data series excluded nearly 62 million people who were studying full-time in universities and so shouldn't be counted as jobless. But that didn't make sense to economists. Statistics typically count anyone actively looking for a job as unemployed, including full-time students. China's National Bureau of Statistics also stopped publishing some numbers related to unemployment in urban areas in recent years. After an anonymous user on the Bureau's website asked why one of those data points had disappeared, the Bureau only said the ministry that provided it stopped sharing the data. China's two major exchanges in Shanghai and Shenzhen abruptly announced that they would stop publishing real-time data on inflows and outflows of foreign investors. The Shanghai Stock Exchange said in a statement that it was aligning its practices with other international markets, which don't disclose real-time trading data of specific groups of investors. After authorities stop publishing real-time data in mid-May, the CSI 300 benchmark index continued its decline for four consecutive months until authorities announced a blitz of measures to support the country's weakening economy in September. Some data are still publicly available, but harder to get. Beijing passed a law in 2021 that caused data providers to make certain information, such as corporate registry data and satellite images, accessible only in mainland China. Chinese data provider Wind Information started to limit international users' access to certain data sets, such as online retail shopping figures and land auction records, in early 2023. That led one economist at a foreign bank in Hong Kong to start making regular weekend trips to the neighboring mainland city of Shenzhen to download data. Also gone in recent years, official figures on Chinese toll road operators' year-end debt balances and the number of new stock market investors. China stopped publishing national cremation data after it ended its controversial zero COVID policy to contain the virus in late 2022, a move some analysts had estimated could lead to between 1.3 million and 2.1 million deaths. The government also censored discussions about the impact of the virus on social media. The country's low fertility rate has become a major economic liability, and some of the data pointing to it are gone too. In the mid-2000s, an economist named Yi Fujian questioned the accuracy of China's population data and argued that tuberculosis vaccinations were a better measure of population growth because every newborn in China is required to be vaccinated. In 2020, 5.4 million such vaccines were administered, according to data compiled by the private Chinese think tank Forward Business and Intelligence. Chinese authorities said the country recorded 12.1 million births that year. A year later, the National Institutes for Drug and Food Control discontinued the weekly data release of tuberculosis vaccine administered, according with other vaccine data. Some information that has disappeared defies explanation. Data providing estimates of the size of elementary school toilets stopped being released in 2022, then resumed publication in February. Official soy sauce production data stopped appearing in May 2021 and hasn't returned. Home prices decline in the South but rise elsewhere. The spring home buying season is off to a slow start. But not everywhere. Buyers are still competing against each other for homes in the Northeast and Midwest, where new supply has been limited and attractive listings can draw crowds. Home prices in parts of the South have been flat or falling, according to Intercontinental Exchange, a financial technology and data company. Even with prices starting to come down, however, Buyers are still struggling to afford purchases in places such as Texas and Florida after prices skyrocketed during the pandemic-era housing boom. Home builders built aggressively in those areas during that time, and now many are sitting on unsold homes after mortgage rates doubled from their lows and relocations to these states slowed down. Overall, the U.S. housing market is far less active than it was a few years ago, when mortgage rates were low and remote work allowed people to move farther from their offices. Just over 4 million existing homes were sold last year, down about one-third from the more than 6 million homes that sold in 2021. The slow sales environment looks poised to persist, especially if mortgage rates hold their near current levels, economists say. Many would-be buyers are on the sideline because of high home prices, mortgage rates that near 7%, and rising costs for property taxes and home insurance. But for the buyers who are in the market, their ability to negotiate with sellers or find a bargain depends a lot on where they are shopping. The most important difference between Bridgeport, Connecticut, and Cape Coral, Florida right now is the supply of homes for sale. The markets with high levels of inventory are either posting price declines already or are the most vulnerable to declines if buyer demand weakens. Across the country, the housing market is divided between markets where the supply of homes for sale is higher than it was before the pandemic, and markets that still have an abnormally low number of homes are on the market. The major markets in the Northeast and Midwest, as well as some southern and western markets, are finding the supply of homes for sale is still below the pre-pandemic levels, and prices are rising. Other areas, mainly in the South, are seeing higher levels of inventories compared with before the pandemic and falling prices. Nationally, the supply of homes for sale is still around 16% below pre-pandemic levels, according to Realtor.com. That is because homeowners who locked in low mortgage rates a few years ago are reluctant to sell their homes and take on new mortgages with a higher borrowing cost. New home construction also plays a major role. Home builders are less active in the Northeast and Midwest due to lower population growth in those regions. During the pandemic, when single-family home construction surged, most of the increase was in other parts of the U.S. When home buying demand soared during the pandemic, many Americans relocated to the South. They wanted lower cost of living, warmer weather, or fewer pandemic restrictions compared with other parts of the country. Many also got new jobs in those fast-growing markets. From 2020 to 2024, the South's population grew 5.1%, with Florida and Texas benefiting the most from population growth. Home builders responded to the surge in demand by aggressively building new homes. This is your reader, John Michael, for the Wall Street Journal. Have a good day.